This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before we get to today's interview, we'd like to extend our sympathies to everyone in London. My guest today is Bob Woodward. Yesterday, New York Times reporter Judith Miller was jailed for refusing to reveal the identity of a confidential source to a grand jury. Yesterday was also the day that Bob Woodward's book about Deep Throat was published. It's called The Secret Man. We're going to hear his thoughts about Miller's jailing and his reflections on his own use of confidential sources, including Deep Throat. Let's start with the jailing of Miller. Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald wants her to reveal to a grand jury what she knows about the leak that Valerie Plame was an undercover CIA officer. Plame's husband, the former ambassador Joseph Wilson, believes her identity was leaked as payback for his criticisms of the Bush administration. Matt Cooper of Time magazine also faced prison for refusing to name his source, even after Time magazine decided to hand over Cooper's emails and notes to the grand jury. But at the last minute, Cooper's source released Cooper from the confidentiality pledge, and Cooper agreed to testify to the grand jury. I asked Woodward his reaction to Miller's jailing.
I think the judge and the special prosecutor made a big mistake, and they should not send her off to jail. There's not the kind of compelling evidence that there was some crime involved here. And my reaction is we ought to wake up and make sure that reporters have access to what's really going on in the government, particularly now, given these terrorist attacks in London. That is when the press has to watch what the government is doing and do the kind of accountability reporting that is essential. You can't do it unless you have confidential sources. The high-profile case, it will freeze people up. They will be very reluctant to help people like myself who are trying to find out what's going on in the investigative national security counter-terrorist world.
Well, do you think that a terrorist attack like the one in London today, do you think living in times of terrorism is an argument for more reliance on confidentiality by reporters, or is it an argument that the government should have more power to insist that journalists reveal who their confidential sources are for the greater good?
It would depend on the case, but in this case involving Judy Miller, the woman who was the CIA undercover operative was working in CIA headquarters. There was no national security threat. There was no jeopardy to her life. There was no nothing. When I think all of the facts come out in this case, it's going to be laughable because the consequences are not that great. If it involves some source in a terrorist organization where the government was trying to find out who was plotting the next attack in America and so forth, you would have a very different set of conditions, and I think probably in those cases reporters would want to assist the government.
Matt Cooper said that his source released him from the confidentiality agreement at the last minute, so Cooper's going to testify to the grand jury. But both Judy Miller and Matt Cooper said they wouldn't respect the waiver of confidentiality forms that investigators had given out, and they considered those forms coercive. What do you know about those forms, and do you think we've entered into a new era with these waivers of confidentiality forms?
Well, it is. I can't tell you how terrible it is to have the government running around saying, oh, we want you to sign this waiver of confidentiality to reporters so we can get at not just who their sources are, but try to figure out who is talking in the government and who reporters are talking to. It's almost worse than the jailing of a reporter, because the sweep and scope of it is so large. It's one of these things. It kind of starts in a small way, and then it becomes a very large issue, and you're going to choke off the flow of good information, particularly the kinds of information that the government doesn't want out, and that's often what needs to be published first.
Has there ever been an effort like this to pressure confidential sources to release reporters from the Pledge of Confidentiality?
Not to my knowledge, and certainly not on this scale.
The editor-in-chief of Time, who decided to turn in documents to the grand jury, said, "We are not above the law." What do you think of that statement? And do you think Judith Miller has put herself above the law?
No, she clearly has said, and the editor of the New York Times has said, this is an act of civil disobedience. She has submitted herself to the law. She said she considers the higher interest here keeping her pledge of confidentiality, that that's even higher than her liberty, her freedom. So she's willing to go to jail. The remedy here, if I may go back to Watergate, was what Judge Sirica did 30-plus years ago when there were competing interests between a prosecutor who wanted Nixon's tapes and Nixon, who was asserting executive privilege, much like a reporter's privilege. In a condition like that, what did Judge Sirica do? He didn't say, turn over the tapes to the grand jury in totality. He said, bring them to me. I'll listen. I will measure the competing interests. And he then did that, and he turned some parts of the tapes over that he thought were relevant, and he kept the rest confidential. A judge can do that. It's too bad Judge Hogan didn't find a middle course in this case.
You know, in the New York Times editorial today, the editorial said that this is far from an ideal case. What makes this case far from ideal?
Well, it's not a classic whistleblower, and the issues don't really involve national security or people's lives or jeopardy or... I think in the end we will find there's not really corruption here. It is such a complex case with players on issues that are not the kind of, you know, we're publishing the truth so the public can learn that a president is a criminal, for instance.
Does this case say anything larger to you about how the government is using its power, or do you think that would be going too far to generalize from this case?
What's interesting here, I think if you had the Bush administration people on your show, they would say they don't like this either. What they did is they appointed a special prosecutor who has total independence. This harkens back to the days of the independent counsels going after Bill Clinton. Once you get one appointed, they have a mandate to almost go anywhere. And, you know, I think one of the independent counsel special prosecutors for Clinton, the Clinton administration, is still working now more than 4 years after the presidency ended. So this special prosecutor in the Judy Miller case has got all of this authority and independence, and it's the peril of giving somebody that kind of blank check.
Bob Woodward recorded this morning. Yesterday we recorded a studio interview about the importance of confidential sources and about Woodward's experiences keeping the secret of Deep Throat, the confidential source who guided Woodward during his investigation into the Watergate cover-up. Most of the manuscript for Woodward's new book, The Secret Man, had been written a while ago. He planned to withhold it from publication until after the death of Deep Throat. But last month, with the permission of Deep Throat and his family, Vanity Fair published an article by the family's lawyer revealing that Deep Throat was Mark Felt, the former number two man in the FBI. After long deliberation, Woodward decided the revelation released him from his pledge of confidentiality. He updated his manuscript and rushed it into print. Woodward told me that he would be willing to go to jail to protect his sources.
We could talk about the present, we could talk about the past, but go back to Nixon and Watergate. What was at stake here? There was, we really had a surveillance world. There was all kinds of wiretapping, break-ins going on. I mean, the list of the Nixon crimes is endless, and There were confidential sources who were willing to help Carl Bernstein and myself. The uncovering of that took place in an environment where we were denounced and threatened, and sources were, could not have taken a greater personal risk to themselves and their careers by assisting.
What were some of the threats against you?
Well, there were no physical threats, though the source Deep Throat, Mark Felt, did say the stakes had grown so large that lives could be at stake. But for days, we would be denounced by the White House. Now, Ron Ziegler, the White House press secretary, would go on for a half hour. I don't know that you've had one of your broadcasts denounced by the White House press secretary ever or for that long, but it gets your attention. The Nixon Reelection Committee chairman went out and denounced us. Bob Dole, who was then the Republican National Committee chairman, devoted a whole speech to us. So it was very aggressive, condemning language, saying not only were we wrong, but that we knew we were wrong, which, of course, now we know the record. We were right, and we knew we were right.
Several newspapers and magazines, including Newsweek, The Washington Post, The New York Times, have tightened their restrictions on anonymous sources. I've been noticing, for instance, in The New York Times, when there's an anonymous source, there's usually a clause within the sentence now explaining why that source feels they need to remain anonymous. What do you think of the way publications are changing the way they handle anonymous sources?
I think by and large it's good. There should be high standards, but at the same time, and I am in a small minority here, I think there should be more anonymous sources, because that's the way you find out what's really going on. You can be careful within a news organization about using them. You can say, I think these descriptive phrases, so-and-so requested anonymity because the White House isn't supposed to talk about the upcoming Supreme Court nominee. That kind of makes sense to people, and I think that adds information. But if we are going to define the news as what the government says publicly and what people say publicly, we're not going to get at what's really going on.
Is there a clause you could have come up with to explain why Deep Throat needed to remain anonymous?
That is a great question. It would have been a whole book because it's very, very complicated. It's personal. It's institutional. This is somebody I knew. He wanted to be protected. He set up rules about contacts and meetings, which I regularly broke and called him on the phone a good number of times, which did not make him happy. Not only was his career in jeopardy, this was sensitive material under investigation. I think he also felt disappointed that he had been not elevated to head the FBI after J. Edgar Hoover's death. I think he also is an old FBI agent who is a spy hunter. Liked the game, to be quite honest with you, and he devised methods to make sure that he was protected. I also think he felt the Nixon administration was making an assault on the law, which we know is the case. Also, Nixon had launched a war on the independence of the FBI, which Mark Felt felt very strongly was important, and that the FBI should not be directed as a secret police agency for political reasons or motives of a sitting president.
Well, that's not only a lot longer than a clause, it would have totally revealed his identity.
Yes, exactly. Good detective work. Yeah. It would have. Yeah. And so sometimes you can't even have that clause, but if you develop a system, as Ben Bradley did at the Post, of requiring two sources, rigorous personal examination of the reporters by Bradley himself, he felt comfortable that we could run these stories. But if there was, and there were efforts in a civil suit to get us to disclose our sources, but the, to my knowledge, in the force of the government was never brought to try to find out our sources.
I'd like to hear your opinion on something that John Stewart said, and I think this was like in his conversation with Bill Moyers, and with apologies to John Stewart, this isn't a direct quote, it's a paraphrase. And what he said was basically, officials don't like leaks, and they don't like leakers, but the Bush administration, figuring that it can't stop the leakers, has tried to poison the well and discredit all of journalism. What do you think?
I would not agree. I've done two books, as you know, on Bush and his war decisions, the war in Afghanistan and the Iraq War. And the Washington Post gave me months or really years to look into these matters, and I developed all kinds of sources, got notes and documentation, classified information about how these decisions were made, and people were willing to talk and answer questions, including the president, who answered questions for 3.5 hours with no restrictions or limitations on the questions about how and why he decided to go to war in Iraq. Now, you may not like the answers, or you may like them, but he did answer, and the questions included all kinds of top-secret information, all kinds of confidential conversations and so forth, to the point that he a number of times asked me, who told you that? There were only two people in the room, or something to the effect of how sensitive something was. But he decided he would answer the questions. And so it's, in a way, extraordinary to have this record of how and why he did what he did in that critical war decision.
While we're on that subject, the Downing Street memos, which were leaked anonymously to a reporter in Britain, did they reveal to you anything about the lead-up to the war in Iraq that you didn't already know from your anonymous sources?
Well, this is such a complicated question. I'm going to say more than I should. As soon as that memo popped up, I started looking behind it, trying to figure out what really happened, and I've seen no evidence at all that the president decided to go to war in July of 2002. I think there was a momentum to war. I wrote stories in the Washington Post about, in fact, a month before, a lead story on a Sunday saying the president had signed a operation order to the CIA, what's called a finding, that they were to proceed to try to overthrow Saddam Hussein in Iraq. So a lot of this CIA war planning and so forth was known, but I think the decision was made later.
Did you already have a set of rules to play by with anonymous sources when you met Mark Felt, Deep Throat, or did you have to make them up as you went along?
That's a very good question. I was very young and new in the newspaper business, and he set the rules. He said, no one is to know. This is to be beyond confidential. He said that he would only confirm information, try to steer us in the right direction. But the idea was, it was going to be on deep background, that there would be no source identified at any time. So he would not only be insulated as a source, the very concept of having a source would not appear in the newspaper.
Did the naming of him as Deep Throat violate that?
It did, and that was done by the managing editor of the Washington Post. And when Carl Bernstein and I wrote All the President's Men, the story of reporting Watergate, I wanted to identify Mark Felt, and I asked him, and he could not have been more strident and emphatic in saying, "Are you crazy?" But I did report on our meetings because it was part of the story, and we wanted to be as thorough and complete as possible, and demonstrating to somebody, this is how you put a story together. It's not about having one source or two. It's about having an array of sources, lawyers, people who worked in the White House, people who worked for Nixon's reelection committee, having law enforcement sources, and so forth. And in the interest of completeness and honesty, we laid it out in the book without identifying him in any way, and his identity remained unknown for 3 decades after that book came out.
It must have weighed on you to identify that there was a deep throat, because you say that after the book came out and became a bestseller, you were afraid not only that Mark Felt would be angry or depressed, you were afraid he'd take his own life.
Well, yeah, because he was so upset. When I called him after the book came out, he hung up on me. And I don't know how often somebody's hung up on you that you knew and dealt with on very important matters. It hasn't happened to me very often, and it is earth-shattering. And I was really worried. I knew that we had not put him in jeopardy because we did not say where he worked. We didn't say it was the FBI. A lot of people thought for decades that it was somebody in the White House or the Nixon administration. So he was protected. But again, this is kind of like your clause after an anonymous source. We were able to tell people there was such a source and what role he played exactly and how emphatic he was in insisting that, you know, I've never had clandestine meetings in underground garages since. He really laid down, I don't know that
you're too famous to do that now. People would recognize
well,
you.
Well, you have to, I think I was 29 at the time and had worked at the Post for less than a year, and you have somebody who's this kind of original FBI agent. He is somebody just physically formidable, very controlled, in this, you know, Hoover's son to a certain extent, somebody who thought Hoover had been a great man, and Hoover dies, and you have this figure saying, this is where we're going to meet, this is how we do it, these are the signals, you tell absolutely no one, you, when you leave your apartment house, you go down the stairway, don't use the elevator, you take 2 cabs, not 1 cab, to the meeting place, you, in fact, walk the last part, get off, I would get off at the Marriott Hotel, which was near there in Roslyn across the Potomac. I mean, it's, you know, and I didn't know, is this common? Is this something people normally do? But he was so important, the story seemed so significant, that I played by his rules.
There were times when you had to lie in order to divert people from who Mark Felt really was. So, for instance, like you would say, no, he's not in the Justice Department.
No,
not in the intelligence community, I mean. Yeah, I thought you'd said that.
No, I never said he was not in the Justice Department. When I was interviewed once a long, long time ago while I was working on a CIA book by it was a long, extensive interview, and I at that time was focused on the intelligence community being the CIA and the National Security Agency and so forth. Technically, the FBI is, but at the time of the interview, they really didn't have much of an intelligence function.
So you feel like you were never in the position of having to lie in order to protect Mark Felt?
Not in those circumstances. I did lie to a colleague, Richard Cohen, who was a columnist, who had deduced that the memos outlining what Felt had said had at the top MF, which I said, which meant my friend, but also could be the initials for Mark Felt, and he was going to write a column saying that Felt was deep throat. And he was insistent on it, and I said, I lied to him and said he was wrong. And he wrote a version of the column very watered down. I've apologized to him since, and he understood, because this is at a time when Mark Felt was being investigated and, in fact, was about to stand trial himself for authorizing FBI break-ins. You know, if you want an irony, there is one of the many ironies in all of this, but Mark Felt was about, in actually had been convicted, could have gone to jail for 10 years, and if this had been disclosed at that time, his law enforcement defense would have been in jeopardy. And so when I weighed that against not telling the truth to my friend Richard Cohen, I did not tell the truth to Richard Cohen.
Yeah, it really is quite an irony with Mark Felt, you know, after helping you uncover the illegal break-in and other connections to the White House and Watergate. It turned out that he later authorized illegal break-ins of members of the Weather Underground, you know, without warrants. So, yeah, talk about ironies.
That's right. And not only, he was doing it at the same time. Now, his
argument... Oh, was it at the same
argument,
time? Okay.
Yes. While... Patrick Gray was the acting FBI director.
Don't you wish you could have talked to him about that and said, why did you do that? How could you do that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, his argument, which he makes extensively in his book, which came out in 1979, is that we were at war, that the Weather Underground was responsible for the bombings in the Pentagon, and there had been one in Congress and so forth.
He meant like a civil war.
Well, I mean, almost. It is a kind of, he actually says we were at war and that there was this violent group, and in order to stop them from doing something really gigantic, we need to find out who these people are, and, well, they knew who some of them were, where they are, and so he authorized these break-ins into the homes of relatives, hoping there'd be a phone number or a letter or a note. As I say in the book, you know, that concept of national security is frightening to me, but that's what he felt at that time and acted on it. And it turned out in the atmosphere, which he, as much as anyone, had helped create, of investigating any wrongdoing by any particularly some organization like the FBI or the CIA, he lit the fuse that eventually came to, it led to his indictment.
Did you ever think that the Deep Throat story would be revealed in the way that it was, by another publication?
No, I did not, and I hoped it would not, but I think it was the Wall Street Journal editorial page after Vanity Fair disclosed Mark Felt's identity. They said congratulations to the Washington Post on being scooped, because the point is for us, we will not reveal confidential sources. And I had visited Felt 5 years ago in California at his home and interviewed him extensively, and he has his memory is essentially gone. So I consulted a lawyer and consulted with Ben Bradley about, can I get him to release me from this agreement of confidentiality? And the feeling was there was no way he was competent to do that. So I had to maintain my silence, and the family did what they did about 5 or 6 weeks ago.
This is an irony that you're protecting the identity of a person after he told his own family, and the family wants to reveal it. So it must have felt like you were doing the right thing, but at the same time, did you feel like the family revealing the identity was like qualitatively different than, say, a columnist who wanted the scoop revealing the identity? Because the person who actually, you know, is credited with writing the article for Vanity Fair is the family's lawyer,
John O'Connor.
Yeah, so I mean, right. he did this like on behalf of the family.
Well, he did, but the standard my lawyer Bob Barnett created for me a number of years ago on this is that you have to, that the source had to competently and voluntarily and completely release me. And after I interviewed Felt, you couldn't even at least get me in the room in terms of saying this is a person who can make a decision like this. At the same time, he lives with his daughter, Joan Felt, who cares about him immensely, is taking care of him. You know, we all should be that lucky to have somebody take care of us if we get in that condition, and by the family lawyer. And so how can you say they did the wrong thing? I would not sit in judgment on them, and Mark Felt seems to be quite happy about it. So there is no downside at the moment.
Was that a happy ending for you then, that, you know, the word is out, he's still alive, you
yeah.
know, and he's happy about it. So it means you don't have to go to your grave thinking that he took to his grave anger about what you did.
Yes, that's right. And I describe at length my visit with him and my sense, because he, as his daughter says, he remembers two people from his Washington past anyway. J. Edgar Hoover, who was the FBI director, and me, Woodward. And he doesn't remember any of the details about anything, but he did say to me, he said, you and Carl Bernstein did the right thing. I think he has an overarching view of what occurred. I think he's got no... I know he has no memory of, you know, the secret signals we used or what he told me, or he even said he didn't recall why Nixon had to resign.
Your book was more or less written a few years ago. You were waiting for Mark Felt's death. I don't mean to put that in a ghoulish way, but you would not publish the book until his death. At least that was the plan. So the manuscript was written, but after he was outed by his family with his own consent, you decided to publish the book. Where had you hidden the book all this time?
Where?
Yeah.
Oh, I wrote it on a computer not connected to the internet. And I wrote it 3 years ago. My wife, Elsa Walsh, read it. Ben Bradley read it and made some comments. My wife Elsa posed, and I think quite wisely, she said, maybe this is just a secret that should never be told, and that when Mark Felt dies, you shouldn't say anything, and the book should not be published, or at least, you know, maybe until I'm gone or something like that. I felt that it's important, particularly at this time. You know, we are in a new security era. We have a Patriot Act. We have spy agencies and intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies and a military and interrogators and so forth who've been let loose. The gloves are off to fight terrorism, and we only get glimpses of things that are going on in this war on terror. There are some monitors and there's some safeguards, but like in the war again, in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, or the war Mark Felt thought existed with the Weather Underground in the late 60s and early 70s, people sometimes step over the line, or the things that we find out many, many years later. So I think from the perspective of now looking back on Watergate, you need to drive home, hammer home, if you will, and I don't mean to get on a soapbox about this, how important it is to have connections to confidential sources who can say, look, this is what really is happening. You don't, as a journalist, you don't get that very often. You may get people who will talk in confidence, who will give you little pieces of things, but we really now, in this new age of surveillance, if I can call it that, we need to make sure that the press is active and that we have in our tool bag all the tools we need, and one of those is being able to go to somebody and say, you're never going to get in trouble for talking to me.
Getting back to how you kept your manuscript a secret, it was on a computer. The computer wasn't connected to the internet. Was your office door locked? I mean, were you afraid
Yes.
you'd have a party guest who'd figure out you might have something on your computer and go hunting?
I've had a locked office at home for almost 30 years, and my wife and daughter don't like it, and I just say, you know, those are the rules I've got to play by.
So it's locked even to your family?
Yes.
You were probably following what some of the conservative press was saying about the revelation of Mark Felt's identity as Deep Throat. And there was an article by Ben Stein, and he said, can anyone even remember now what Nixon did that was so terrible? He ended the war in Vietnam, brought home the POWs, ended the war in the Mideast, opened relations with China, started the first nuclear weapons reduction treaty, saved Eretz Israel's life, started the Environmental Protection Administration. Does anyone remember what he did that was so bad? Oh, now I remember. He lied. He was a politician who lied. How remarkable. And then he basically says that by getting him impeached, you, Bernstein, Ben Bradley and Mark Felt made the Cambodian genocide possible. Let me say this
Wow.
again. He says that basically by getting him impeached, you, Bernstein, Ben Bradley and Mark Felt made the Cambodian genocide possible. He writes, you, Felt and Bradley, out of their smug arrogance and contempt, they hatched the worst nightmare imaginable, genocide. I hope they're happy now. And then Pat Buchanan and Rush Limbaugh also hold you responsible for the fall of Vietnam.
Yeah.
What's your reaction to that?
Well, first of all, the real conservatives, the people who believe in the rule of law, hold a never-ending outrage at what Nixon did. And we can remember what Nixon did. He was a criminal president. Go listen to the Nixon tapes. And, you know, you've got me started on this, and I'm going to go through and rebut with the record that on the tapes, Nixon regularly orders lying to law enforcement, to the grand jury, to use the FBI, the IRS, to screw, as he puts it so eloquently, or he has another version of that verb, any of his opponents. Not only is this criminal and abusive, and that is the basic foundation of our government. It is a government that is answerable, and Nixon became unanswerable. He became a power unto himself. Wiretap, break-in. He had the Secret Service wiretap the telephone of his renegade brother. The list of things that went on that are horrifying doesn't stop. But then you go to the tapes and you listen to the tapes, and I've listened to a number of them and read transcripts of them. The real nightmare is the dog that doesn't bark on the Nixon tapes. No one says, including Nixon or his innermost aides, what would be right, what would be good, what does the country need? What is the high purpose of the presidency that we're here to do good? It's always about Nixon. And so in the end, it's about the smallness of this man. I'm sorry to get so wound up there. But the idea that somehow by reporting and establishing the illegality of what Nixon did, that somehow because that caused the fall of Vietnam. I mean, Vietnam was heading off the cliff long before. And the idea that somehow what happened in Cambodia is attributable to this. I mean, other columnists, conservative columnists, have written, well, Nixon was a serious president. He was somebody, and this is the tire iron around his neck, which he will never get out of. Those tapes just tell this story of somebody who just didn't belong in the presidency. And to try to bring to the public information about that. We weren't, and I'm still not on a crusade about it, quite frankly, but that's the job. And for people to somehow say, oh, this is not going to be remembered, don't understand the record.
My guest is Bob Woodward. His new book, The Secret Man, is the story of his relationship with Deep Throat. If I'm remembering correctly, after the Vanity Fair, well, before the Vanity Fair piece came out, but after everybody knew that it was going to come out, Ben Bradley was on one of the cable talk shows, and he said that for years all he knew was that about Deep Throat was that you told him he was a highly placed person in intelligence or the Justice Department. I forget the way you...
Justice Department.
Yeah. But he didn't know his name. When did you tell him his name?
I told him his name after Nixon resigned. Ben took me out on a park bench in McPherson Square, a couple of blocks from the Post, and sat down and said, I need to know who this is. I think he had some indication there might be some attack on us even after Nixon resigned, and so I told him and gave him the name, rank, and serial number. And Ben has said, and I think quite rightly, he would never let the identity of a critical source go undisclosed to him as editor for that long. And I think in the environment we're in now, he would call a reporter in, close the door, and grill him or her, and rightly so. And I have always believed that one editor should know who confidential sources are, and I tell one editor at the Post, Len Downey, always voluntarily, I say, you need to know this, and he takes the information in and is tight-lipped as anyone, doesn't tell anybody else, but the top guy needs to know.
Looking back on the whole Watergate story, is there anything that you wish you had done differently?
Sure. We should have figured it out sooner. We should have worked harder. We should have put the pieces together. Names would surface in the investigations, and Carl and I would knock each other on the head and say, you know, we never saw her, or we never went to that person. We should have. But as I look back on it and reflect back on it, the real issue is, are we going to have secret government in this country or not? And that's where we were headed with Vietnam and Watergate, a level of secrecy and fear and surveillance unheard of outside of the constitutional and legal system we have, and that what reporters are working when we work in these areas about particularly the federal government or local police force, we're saying no secret government. We're going to find a way to tell people what's really going on, and that, you know, if there's anything, my view, that's going to do us in the end, it's not going to be terrorism, it's not going to be a war, it's not going to be an economic collapse, it's secret government. That will wreck our system, and the first or one of the barriers to that is a press that can operate freely, and people in government or business or NPR or wherever who can go and talk to somebody and say, this is the truth.
For over 30 years, you've carried a secret. You're not carrying it anymore. Does life feel any different not having to hold on to that secret any longer?
I've grown accustomed to holding on to it, so it doesn't feel any different. And I hope there's some lesson here, and I'm repeating myself for the eighth time, about the importance of having Mark Felts, Deep Throats, confidential sources, whatever you want to call them, deep in the reaches of our most secret institutions, who will explain and answer and, if necessary, blow the whistle.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bob Woodward's new book about Deep Throat is called The Secret Man. You can read an excerpt of the book on our website, freshair.com.